Welcome to Artist Materialist, Episode 6, One Laptop Per Child's Legacy. I'm Dan, a material scientist.
And I'm Susanna, an artist and graphic designer. And today we are going to discuss an article in The Verge titled, OLPC's $100 Laptop Was Going to Change the World, Then It All Went Wrong, written by Addie Robertson. And you found this article. How did you come across it?
I think it was in my Twitter feed. I don't remember from who, but it was in the Twitter feed.
And it talks about the famous green laptop that was going to cost $100, and it was going to give every child around the world their own laptop. And how that initiative started and where it ended up. And it's an interesting.
Yes. And I think the title, having going down some of the rabbit holes that it links to, it really seems like it did change the world.
It did. And it's sort of a catalyst that started a lot of these changes that presented some bold ideas. So even if they didn't really meet their original goals, they got people thinking about some ways that technology could be used outside of how people originally perceived what laptops were.
And this is so the origin of this, as the article goes into, is it grew out of the MIT Media Lab. Specifically, the founder of the MIT Media Lab, Nicholas Negroponte, who had a real idea that the thing that education needed was it needed opportunities to create things, and that this is a way to spread equality around the world was to go into places that didn't have a lot and give every kid a laptop, and then they would be able to make things on their own, and then they could all become software entrepreneurs and change the world. And yeah, if he was the Steve Jobs, then the other, I want to make sure that we also talk about the Woz in this situation, who is Mary Lou Jepsen, also long time at the MIT Media Lab, who really turns out to be the Woz to Nicholas Negroponte's Steve Jobs in this. You were saying.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought Walter Bender was more of the Woz in this situation, the guy who ended up doing the sort of, the practical stuff. but you're right, Mary Louise Jepsen was sort of was another one. They really had the three, and two of them went off in the practical directions, and one stayed in the visionary. And the thing is, they never really all stayed together. They kind of went off in their own directions, but they each did something useful in their own way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Such as academia, I suppose.
Yeah, because Negroponte, his original idea was to have this laptop that was low cost and extremely rugged, and he wanted to have millions of them, and he sort of stayed with the idea of distributing this technology to kids in areas where they didn't have much access to technology. And then I want to make sure it's Mary Louise Jepsen or Mary Lou Jepsen. I'm trying to.
Mary Lou Jepsen.
Mary Lou Jepsen, sorry. She had the idea of, she eventually left to make this screen company that would make low cost technology components. And then, if I'm correct, Walter Bender, he left to go work with the software part of the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
So, which they created their own minimal creation-centered Linux operating system called Sugar OS. And so they all kind of stayed with the project, but in very different ways. So do you remember when this thing first came out? Because I have a vague memory of when this was unveiled.
I certainly saw a lot of things about it, and it was very heavily hyped, and so I saw a lot of stories about it, and I remember thinking, oh, that's cool, and at the same time, oh, that's very ambitious, because sort of the aspect, I guess, that fascinated me the most was, and why I focused more on Mary Lou Jepsen, is that it was her working with the supplier on how to get the cost down for the hardware components. It turns out the article talks about this, the Asus Tech Triple E netbook, the very first netbook,
Yes.
was developed, and there's a link off of this article, there's was developed as a response to all of the things that Mary Lou Jepsen was doing with their competitor. So there's like, they saw, oh my gosh, they're making this cheap netbook for the low end of the market. We better do something ourselves. And so they made it. And then it turned out that everybody wanted to buy one. And that kicked off the whole, and at the time, $400, which seems preposterously expensive now for a netbook, but that was less than half the cost of other laptops at the time. And all of a sudden, netbooks started just going everywhere. And of course, giant creative destruction. If everybody had to spend $1,000 on a laptop, and now people are realizing they can get by with something that costs 400, that's quite a change.
Yeah, and remember that, the first iPhone didn't even come out until mid 2007. So the idea of something that was sm that small and portable and powerful was really new. It's amazing to think how much technology has changed just since 2005 when the OLPC was first introduced.
And very much on the hardware cost side, aided by cloud computing, as opposed to, it's not that we have some sort of completely different operating system, where it's not like everybody uses VR or AR to interact with their phones, but the costs are certainly very different and what we think of as necessary.
Yeah, I mean, I got my kids for Christmas a few years ago, $900, Kindle tablets, and they're incredibly powerful, fairly rugged. We did destroy a couple, but it's just amazing how far the technology's come. And while you're focusing on the hardware of it, really what interested me in here was the focus on the software of it and how much it mattered at the time back when they were first starting this initiative that they use Linux and not Mac OS. And when somebody suggested using Windows because that's what was most familiar to most people, that was heresy. And I do remember the huge rifts in the technology community between the different operating systems. I mean, it's as bad as, the red and blue political divides are now. That's what it was like. And so, and now it's like, you use Android, you use iOS, it doesn't really matter, whatever works.
Right now, the only thing that's still that divided is the what you which code editor that you use, whether I forget which the two are. I've never gotten this far. I just know that there's a divide between Emacs or something and
Oh,
Vim,
yes. Yeah,
but that's not as widespread as Mac versus PC. I mean, they didn't even call it Windows, they just called it PC.
and I mean, and the Linux world, the open source world, was a lot more militant about staying away from commercial software at that time. Not that they're not devoted to that still. I mean, the open source community is still, very committed to what they're doing and committed to having open source software. But back then it was a lot more of an almost religious devotion. And I think the fact that commercial software has embraced open source and there has tamped that down a lot. It's now kind of accepted that open source is okay, it's a good thing, and it's something that people should spend their time on and use, and it's worthwhile. Whereas
Well,
back then, that wasn't necessarily the case.
when was it that because Mac OS switched over at some point to being based on having more of a open source underpinnings. I don't know when that was.
That was in 1999.
Oh, was that far ago?
Yeah, well, I mean the official that was the server version came out, but
Oh,
the
okay.
it was 2001 when OS 10 that was based on the Linux backend came out, and that
Oh,
was yeah, it was a long time ago. But it was pretty revolutionary that it had, you know, its own flavor of Unix backend. That was pretty amazing. Everyone was, you know,
well,
impressed
I
by it,
can't
I
believe that
remember.
was 16 years ago
I
or
know.
19 years ago. That's wow. There's a lot of history in computer history at this point.
I know I've had to look up so much stuff while I've been while I was reading this article and say, oh gosh, I remember that, but when did that happen? You know?
And that was what sort of with the ask the tack that the article takes about how things going wrong, and it was one of the big things is it's sort of talking about especially the crank, which is did seem like a very both ambitious and also very sort of a first world perspective on what a developing world nation needs. It's like, okay, well, if we're going to send these laptops to the middle of nowhere, we're gonna have to they're gonna have to have their own electricity, so we'll put a hand crank on it. And that ended up being vaporware, which is something that happened a lot more in that era.
Yes, and
Vaporware was
it
very common.
was, I mean, I'm now, you know, very immersed in the whole design process and how you create prototypes and the right way to create prototypes. You know, you have the product definition, then you do your research, analysis, design, and testing, and then you iterate and you create just a little bit of the prototype at each time and making sure you always test it and that always works, and you only release when you have a small incremental working something. But yeah, the vaporware that came out back then was pretty impressive.
One,
And the
yeah.
thing that, yeah, the how you talked about what with the first world concept of what the third world needed, that was something that just struck me throughout this article again and again, is they never really considered the human factors, the factors outside the technology that related to what they were doing. I mean, there was that one teacher who said, you know, why don't we focus on getting clean water and good schools
Yeah.
instead of computers?
Well, and it, right off the bat, what the Nicholas Negroponte had, I guess, just privately, he went off and did a pilot project of getting a whole classroom computers, and he was excitedly talking about how it was their only source of light and that they could use it like that. And it's like, well, then why not just send some lights?
Yeah.
Which is a
And
whole.
that was,
There's a
you were
whole
gonna
other
say.
separate thing about, I mean, there's a whole field of low cost LEDs and all that whole story is a whole separate thing, which is very fascinating, especially for, more from a materials perspective.
And really, didn't the sort of the LED technology was not as good then as it is now, isn't that correct?
Yeah, no, it's it was, I mean, so blue LEDs were out by, I mean, they had been developed by 2000, 2002, around there. I mean, so they existed, but they were very expensive, and that wasn't really, didn't have anything to do with laptops at that time.
I mean, I remember just getting an LED screen for, I did some work with, back in the early 2000s, did some work with trade shows and showing stuff there. And so, you know, just renting a giant LED screen was incredibly expensive. You would never even consider buying one because it would cost $5,000 just to buy one that would be, you know, a $500 TV today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, was so that was that I mean, there's the true LED screens, the which are mostly like the OLED ones, like the new iPhone screens. And then you have what I call fake LED screens, which are the ones that they just have an LED backlight.
Ah, okay. No,
Which is,
I'm haven't examined much the difference between these.
yeah. So with the most of the TVs, unless you buy the really high-end ones, when they say that they're LED, that just means that they basically have, instead of having a fluorescent lamp or whatever kind of lamp behind the LCD, they have a LED lamp behind the LCD,
Ah, okay.
which is good for, lower energy consumption, and it lasts longer, but it's still going through the LCD.
All right, well, that makes sense. And I guess getting back to, talking about how the original project that Negroponte had with the computers in the Cambodian school and that gave him the idea for this, is he started out doing it the right way, in a small trial to see if it worked, sort of an initial prototype. And he found some And he found that it did work, that the kids were able to, pick this up and they learned some from it. But to me, the thing that bothered me was that he immediately took that small scale test and said, okay, now we're going to bring it to scale. We're going to scale it
Right.
up and make millions of these things. There was no intermediate step between, 20 kids in a classroom and millions of kids around the world.
Well, why go through the development valley of death if you can just leap over it, right?
That's right. Yeah, no need to iterate, just jump
Just
across
jump.
the Grand Canyon.
And I don't know what that would have looked like, the intermediate step. And I
Well,
don't
I
know.
think it might have looked like what happened much later, where they talk about, where eventually the Exo computers ended up, which was OLPC's actual built computers, not the prototype, but they had the XO1, XO2, et cetera. And they distributed them to a lot of schools, and especially in Latin America. And they are still using them in some places.
Yeah.
And that was really the intermediate step that they never planned for.
I think that was one of the things that it really came away, and you mentioned earlier about about giving the gift of Kindle tablets, at least one of which is already broken, is that some of their goals, especially in terms of durability, I mean, they talk about how they're still around, and that really is an accomplishment for a laptop to survive being around kids for several years.
No kidding. I mean, that was a good ambition that they had to ruggedize this. And I think that's something that there's still a great market for is rugged technology. I mean, that's why OtterBox makes so much money, because you want to have this delicate little iPhone or Galaxy, and you need to put something tough around it so that you can use it in the real world.
That certainly lowers the cost, even if it's more upfront. Sure, you can get a little tablet for $40 or something, but if you drop it on something hard, it will break.
Oh, yes, yes, it will. One thing that this article reminded me of, do you remember hearing about the guy who made a toaster from scratch?
Yes.
And so I looked him up. His name was Thomas Thwaite, and he was a designer who decided to see what it would take to make a toaster from scratch. And he went through the whole process of, figuring out all the components and even mining them himself and all this. And he discovered that you really need the global supply chain and expertise of many people to make a complex piece of technology like a toaster. And I think that was the thing that struck me while I was reading this too, was that OLPC started out in the mentality of, we're going to do this all ourselves. And as they spread apart into their various logistics and software and hardware pieces, they actually became more successful. They needed that global supply chain and they came across too, the the political realities, the infrastructure realities, like no electricity and having to figure out how to distribute them through the schools and all that. I mean, it was really a lot of different pieces working together to make it successful. And it wasn't something that any one small company could really do by themselves. And that's something that I come across a lot when I'm reading about these visionary startups is, I mean, it's great to have this idea that you're going to disrupt food distribution or disrupt whatever industry, but thinking that you can do it single-handedly is maybe not correct.
And speaking of the political realities, that was a very interesting thing to me when you're, because of course there the whole idea of this project was to send these laptops to countries that are not, they're not part of the G7 or G8 or whatever. And countries that are struggling have all sorts of different political realities, and so you had certain countries that did want to, I'm guessing countries that maybe had some oil wealth or something, maybe new oil wealth, wanted to buy these laptops as a way to show that they were paying attention to their citizens. And on the other hand, you had the countries that said, well, wait, you're just going to build all of these in Taiwan using the big current laptop manufacturers? Like, why would I spend all this money on something that's not even built in our own country? Don't we have pride? And it made me think of this other story that was I heard on the NPR's Marketplace, where, or is it Marketplace, or it's the other one, Planet Money, NPR's Planet Money, where they went and investigated this thing where BlackBerry built a factory in Argentina, because Argentina said you can only buy cell phones that are built in Argentina. And so they built this factory in Argentina, in the least developed part of it, at the far, far southern end of Argentina. So it's about as far as away from the rest of the supply chain as you can get. And just the parade of ridiculous things that happened as a result of that. You can imagine it took a long time and a lot of money to get things up and running. And by the time they did that, the phone they were making was obsolete.
Yep. I think I remember hearing about that. It's something that you really have to take into account is the human factor. I mean, and that includes politics and things like, the pride in locally built stuff and even the logistics of handing out stuff to students. Back when I worked at USC, there was a project. The professor I worked for had this thing that had been his life's ambition, and it was this idea of having a device, sort of a networked system that would allow the professor to on the fly enter a question for the class or say a question for the class and let the entire class, no matter how many students were in it, give answers and have the answers projected on a screen so you could see what everybody answered. And I know we have these clicker systems, but this was going to be, a
Free
lot
response.
more free response, yes.
Wow.
And yeah. And so that and the back end would do all the work. And he actually built this system back in the 80s, believe it or not. I
Oh,
mean, yeah, I mean it was very ahead of its time. And so when the first iPods came out, you remember they were like iPhones, not the first iPods, the first flat screen iPods, the ones that looked like iPhones but weren't phones yet. He was so excited and he wanted to rebuild his system from the 80s using this new technology. And so I worked with him and some grad students and people to build this system for one of the classes he taught. And, it kind of worked. I think maybe if he'd had, I don't know, people who were better programmers or something, or maybe a less, maybe, a less visionary requirements for building it. It might have worked better. But part of the problem was just the logistics of distributing these devices, because we ordered about, 20, I think it was, no, it's like 50 of these little iPods that were brand new. They were really expensive when they first came out. We ordered a bunch of those for the class, and then we had them on carts, and they had to be powered up. They all had to be connected to the school's Wi-Fi, and we had to distribute them at the beginning of class, and then they had to be returned at the end of class. And so we had to keep track of them, and it was just, it was,
That's the whole
we
class
had.
right there.
I know, it was very time consuming to do that. On top of it, the system didn't quite work right. And I mean, it was better than the clickers, I think, because he could ask a question and then have people, give extemporaneous answers, but the interface wasn't quite right, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was still a little ahead of our time. And now, what I was talking to some parents of high school students yesterday, and they were saying that teachers are now trying to incorporate the kids' phones into the classroom so that the logistics aren't such a problem anymore, because so many kids have smartphones. They can do something like that and have the kids enter, and we have enter answers, and we have all these network systems already created to facilitate that. It's just a lot easier, and the systems that were developed to allow that, sort of have sprung up over the last few years.
Now you could just have a Slack channel or a Twitch feed or any number of things where you just have everybody's things pop up. It seems kind of easy now, and at least I don't know if it's the same sort of
Oh,
setup.
exactly. Slack, I mean, would basically be the same thing. The professor could ask a question, and everybody's on the Slack channel, and they just type it in, and it all shows up. I mean, it would be so easy. But I mean, I guess all the little things that make that easy now are things that didn't exist back when this idea first came out. So I guess our discussion has made me appreciate a little more the visionary idea behind the whole OLPC initiative. I do tend to be very dismissive of sort of those big ideas initially, just because I see all of the pitfalls and all the things that can go wrong.
And I guess it's one of those shoot for the stars and you might get to the moon kind of moments. And it's really impressive all the things that it kicked off and talking about the netbooks, the Triple E Asus netbook, and then as a result of that, Microsoft actually pushed off getting rid of XP, Windows XP for 2 years because they were worried about losing market share, and so they sold XP into netbooks for 2 more years instead of switching everything over to Vista. All sorts of things that came out of this very ambitious thing. And that same article that links off of it was saying that in 2009, that OLPC was the number four netbook maker.
Wow, that's impressive.
And I do remember, and this is when you're saying about remembering things, I certainly remember the whole buy one, give one, which was
Yes.
very popular for a lot of things. Tom's Shoes, I remember, was another big one. And I guess more recently, Warby Parker, but that this was definitely one of those early buy one, give one laptop per child things.
Yeah, and it mentions toward the end of the article that they never really did a lot of follow-up in figuring out how much the OLPC and these other netbook initiatives helped kids learn. I mean, how much did it help education? And that's something that, goes all the way down to the Apple's MacBooks for schools initiatives, or the iPads for schools, something that has gotten a lot of criticism too. And I don't know, how much has it helped kids to have these computers in their classrooms? Is it something we can measure? How much can we measure? I don't know.
Yeah,
I would
so
like to know.
yeah, there's the thought that of the digital divide and just being comfortable with the existence of a computer and knowing kind of how to work one a little bit lets you get opens up a number of jobs that otherwise, if you're don't grow, it's sort of the resource, just having it around makes a difference.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, you want to know basic things like how to select and cut and paste and use a mouse and all that stuff. That is pretty basic, but I think that what really makes a difference that I've noticed, and this is something that the original founders were committed to, is having a focus on creation as opposed to simply use. The original XO1 was designed, and the sugar operating system was designed with a focus on helping kids create stuff using the computer. And I think that's very important. Understanding how the thing works, being able to take it apart and put it together, or even if you can't do that, knowing what the parts are and not being afraid to poke around in the guts. I think that's really maybe as important as learning how to use a mouse.
Yeah, that certainly goes. My favorite book that I love to mention, Diamond Age, by Neal Stephenson, certainly goes into that a lot about the importance of creating as part of learning. And it does contrast with there's other programs. I don't know if they were associated with this or something else about sending hard versions of sort of frozen in time versions of Wikipedia. I think that's mentioned in here
Yeah,
someplace.
it's mentioned they talk about, and this that was what it says, Samir Verma. He's at Sugar Labs, and he's comes from one of those sort of third world communities that doesn't have a lot of technology in it, and he's helped develop those laptops that have the that aren't connected but have, like you said, the preloaded Wikipedia and other information on them, because he was aware of what those communities needed.
And I think more recently the stories that I've seen that about transformational technology uptake has been cheap text messaging, especially and even information that you can get via text message. So like rural farmers getting the daily price for the thing that they sell, the daily spot price, so they don't get taken advantage of.
That's interesting.
So very, sort of everything distilled down to extremely what's of extreme local interest. And okay, what's I'm what I really want is I want to be told what the price and the price of wheat and the upcoming weather. That's what I want to know. And everything else, I can gossip with my friends and I can talk about various things, but in terms of immediately making life better, what do I need to know? I need to know the weather and the price of wheat. And
And
that can be sent a text.
yeah. And that really does come back down to what I was talking about making a good design process is when you're working on the product definition, what you're just when you're deciding what to create, you want to create the smallest working prototype that meets the goals users have. And that's a great example of doing that. Well, this has been a very interesting look into the history of technology over the past couple decades.
Yeah. Well, and
Thank
if
you for suggesting this article.
it's I'm glad it popped up just a few days ago. Well, if you'd like to find out more about us, you can find us at anchor.fm/artistmaterialist or wherever you find your podcast.